Welcome to the December edition of the Dance Futures podcast. And of course, I had to do a Christmas special because you have to, don't you? So instead of an interviewee this week, talking about all things dance, we have got myself and my regulars, Robin and Luca, and we are queering the Nutcracker. There are some serious bits and some very silly bits. I hope that for ballet fans and people who have never watched ballet in their lives, there will be something in here for you. You will notice in the recording some different sound levels. That's because we had to do it twice, because things never go all smoothly at Christmas, do they? There's one recording with Luca in the room and one recording with him remotely, but that shouldn't make any difference to your enjoyment. And please, any experts out there, I'm happy to stand corrected on any factual inaccuracies. We were running with our artistic license in a big way during this episode, and I hope you'll enjoy it as much as we did. And so we decided, though, this year to do a little Christmas special and watch the Nutcracker Ballet together with you, dear listener. Don't worry, we're going to skip through the boring bits, and we're going to have a go at kind of queering it. And I guess what that means as a verb, as a doing thing, is looking at how we view it through the eyes of today, and how we think about it being less heteronormative, maybe, or more, just more expansive and up to date, mm-hmm. I guess. And I feel like we're coming from these really different positions on it as well, right? So I am a dance scholar, that's my profession, and yet I always feel like I don't know very much about ballet and that really I should know more. And it's come up before, I think, around like hierarchies of knowledge and things like this, but it always, always comes up. It's such a key point of reference, and it is a joyful thing for a lot of people as well as a difficult thing. So this was part of like an idea of like bringing ballet into the current discourse. And also, you know, festive, isn't it? But we have got somebody here who knows a bit more about ballet than me, probably.
Yeah.
That would be me.
Ballet was one of the first dance, I suppose, for a lot of us actually in the dance world. Ballet is usually the first kind of style that we're introduced to in a formal setting, and you get taught it in this very codified way. But that always really stuck with me, and I like watching ballet, and I would say that in my own dance practice, my ballet classes are a really important part of that, and the way that I move draws heavily on the aesthetic of ballet. So
yeah. And what about you, Robin?
Well, we were talking about sort of going into watching this and how we're going to approach it from different, I suppose, biases in a way. And I was like, yeah, there's no way I can walk into watching a ballet and be like, yay, ballet. and maybe it's just the mood of today as well. But I think, yeah.
I think there's a lot of people
that excites me.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that feel like that, right? Mm. So I think in a way that's one of the challenges, maybe. For me, it's like I look at it like a cultural artifact almost, like it's something that keeps getting, the Nutcracker just keeps getting passed down, passed on. And every year, there it is, you know, in some shape or form. And so I guess like, you know.
I think it's been around for so many years now, and it's become such a tradition that people don't challenge their view of it. It's just accepted that it's something that you do at Christmas, if that's the kind of upbringing that you've had, that you know you go and watch the Nutcracker every year, or you hang little Nutcracker decorations on your tree, whatever kind of connection you have to the ballet. But actually it's really interesting sometimes to step back and reassess our kind of connections and our viewpoints on something.
Totally love that. Oh!
Drama.
That was from Act 4. Sorry, skip ahead. That's how well I know it. I told you. Right, we're going to raise the curtain on this, baby. So, Act 1.
Act 1, baby.
Act 1 is... Act one is very Christmassy when the curtain comes up. Can I just say this is like the biggest Christmas tree?
Oh my God.
Wasn't it? It's the biggest Christmas tree.
Humongous.
It is massive and it does take center stage as well.
Yeah, and it makes all the dancers look really small, although a lot of the children, right? Are they not?
Tiny, tiny little dancers.
What's happening in, what happens in Act One, Luca?
Yeah, Luca, this is your territory.
Whoa, okay. So the rundown in Act One is we get introduced to Clara and her family, and all the little poor children from the village get invited up to the big, big castle, and they have a lovely time. And we see the rich people invite the poor little peasants into their home. To give
this
them
is like this is they do a lot of skipping around as well,
they right? do a lot of skipping around,
so they're obviously enjoying their like little brief visit to the upper echelon of society. Yeah. But it's a, like a very specific and I hope kind of outdated idea of charity, although I feel like it still happens, right? But this thing of sort of like the bourgeoisie sort of like making sort of almost easing their consciences by providing this little moment in time, but it's not actually anything very real or sustainable, right?
It's one night only where they're like, look, we do care, and then they kick them back to their little cold houses and they say see you next year for 1 hour.
Yeah, and the children get given some presents as well, so the boys all get given swords and the girls all get given dolls because
gender.
because gender.
Because the binary.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what about, one of the most... Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, what about the movement? Is that really gendered as well? Like, are they like swiping around with their swords and the girls like, oh, I'm playing with my dolly?
Yeah, we see the boys sort of charging across the stage. Ironically, a lot of the young male characters are played by female dancers because... of the body types that they have, they can often get away with casting them in male roles because they have slim, small, petite frames.
Okay, that's really interesting, isn't it, in terms of this, of the kind of androgynous ideal that is also like seems to exist in the, you know, in the fashion world these days for like a...
The fashion, like celebration of female beauty, and yet it's like completely androgynous and sometimes super masculine as well. I found it interesting watching because I don't watch a lot of ballet.
No.
Don't know if you guys but I didn't know why like men didn't do point. Like I knew that they didn't, or traditionally they don't. I don't know if that's changing now. But I asked like why that was. And you said it's about men not being fragile and delicate, like that's why the women wear them. But then also they're like super clunky. Like when they're not like dancing on point, but they have point shoes on, they're just, it's hilarious.
Yeah, like, they look kind of like little pasties, don't they?
Just a little shout out that the fact we're in Cornwall.
Yeah.
Pasty crew.
Pasty point.
Pasty point. Creating a whole new genre there. So I guess like the question is then, like if we were queering it, if we're thinking about like how might we make this less gendered, it's that thing as well, isn't it? It's not just about swapping and being like, well, boys can have the dolls and girls can have the swords and the associated movement vocabulary. It's also allowing like the autonomy to kind of choose to be anywhere on that spectrum, right? Mm. And so that somehow those interactions are just less binary, like you
said. But like why does it have to be like everyone gets swords or dolls? Like what about, I don't know, a big truck or
ooh, a big truck. Sorry, but was it just me the way you said that?
a big truck.
Or some gardening. Yeah. Some gardening implements. Like sewing stuff. Sorry, this is okay.
Give the children spades.
Spades. No, but it's true actually that like swords are associated with violence, right? Mm. And like war and like aggression and and I'm not even gonna talk about what vagina actually means.
What?
No, you can't say that. I'm not.
What do you mean?
Isn't it like isn't the origin of the word vagina something about like a sheath for a sword or something?
Oh my god. Yeah.
No.
Why are we living life like this? I'm never calling it that again.
Anyway, back to the ballet.
My god.
What? Back to the ballet, Luca. Help, help.
It's probably really crucial to mention. Yeah, what? Yeah, the Nutcracker.
Yeah, like where does the Nutcracker come in?
Who would play it?
The Nutcracker gets given as a gift by one of, I think he's an uncle to Clara. He's kind of like this, I mean, Robin's face has just lit up.
There is a theory.
Sorry, but the word vagina comes from the Latin word for sheath or scabbard, which is what a sword goes in. So this is that. I wasn't making that up, guys. So there was a relevance there. And it's intense, right? It's really intense when you hear that.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that's a whole, it's a whole kind of discussion, but etymology and where words come from and the power that they hold, right? And
that's so interesting.
It's really interesting. But in terms of, we have only, there's only so many words that we might feel comfortable using. And I think it's, you know, meanings change over time, so it doesn't necessarily mean that that is still what it means. But that was my little brain just having a little moment there with the swords. I'm sorry about that. There are all kinds of lovely words that we can use, but that's not what this podcast is about. Guys,
this is not what we came here for. We came here to talk about the Nutcracker and the uncle.
Yeah, tell us about the uncle.
Luca calls the
Gunkle. which is Zuma speak for a gay uncle, and if we're queering this ballet, then in my version, uncle is gay, and that's because I just feel like it's such a pop culture trope to have like a way of including sort of gay characters in storylines, is that like they're not going to be part of the nuclear family ideals, but they're kind of like existing on the peripherals of family conventions. So you can still, you know, producers and directors can still tell very kind of like clean, PC, non-problematic stories about families. And then, you know, when they need to like bring in some diversity, the uncle pops around for dinner and
okay, but you don't know much about him, you just know that he's queer and he's here for a bit.
And this, we were reflecting, weren't we, on how in relation to Tchaikovsky's sexuality, which we'll hear in the next section, but that maybe there's something interesting about the fact that there's a solo man as the sort of protagonist as well of the story, right?
Yeah, so that could be definitely one interpretation that this lone male figure comes into the story and is kind of responsible for causing all the magic to happen, I suppose. He's the one who gives Clara the Nutcracker that later turns to life and becomes a prince.
It is pretty well acknowledged by biographers and musicologists that Tchaikovsky was gay. And there's tons of evidence of this in his personal letters.
Yeah, I was just about to say, like, how do they, you know, I feel like in this day and age, there's sort of like such a kind of onus on people kind of, you know, owning their sexuality in this very outward way. But we didn't have the same sort of, there wouldn't be the same documentation, but yeah, so letters.
Letters were, and luckily they all survived, but they were kind of hidden and probably some of them were destroyed by the Russian state because it was this huge scandal that such a Russian icon could be gay. And rather than completely getting rid of Tchaikovsky from Russian culture. They just hid the fact that he was gay. Mm. So they kind of wanted to take him for the bit that was going to help them continue to spread ballet culture around the world, but not acknowledge the fact that he liked men. And his brother was also gay, and they wrote lots of letters to each other talking about their feelings and relationships they had. His brother was much more openly gay than he was, and lived with another man quite publicly.
Oh, wow.
And he and Tchaikovsky wrote to his brother when he was 36, and I think this is absolutely heartbreaking. He said, quote, "I think for both of us, our dispositions are the greatest and most insuperable obstacle to happiness, and we must fight our natures to the best of our ability." End quote.
That's so sad.
Yeah, so there's this, he had this really kind of toxic self-hatred towards his sexuality. So much
it's kind
so.
Of amazing to think that, like, you can, you know, be going through that and still produce these sort of epic works.
Yeah,
right? Like,
well, I think music was probably his greatest escape. It was like the time that he could kind of shut off all those feelings. And actually, there's evidence from his letters as well that a lot of his relationships and breakups fed into the drama of his music, and
I can relate.
Famously, art is best produced when going. That's why every song ever is written about heartbreak. Art comes from pain.
Yeah,
a lot of the time.
I know, it's a bit sad, isn't it? Yeah. Like, I feel like we were talking about joy, weren't we, in the last episode with
Camille.
Thank you. Camille. I feel like it's important that it can come from joy too. But yeah, that is is really harsh hearing that. If you think about what we said at the beginning about, like, looking at this with eyes from today, like, do you guys, how do you relate to that in any shape or form? Like, do you feel like there was any moment where you're like not accepting and hiding? Yeah.
Well, like, it's so, it's like, I don't at all, like, with specifically with my queerness, it's never felt like something that will ever impact me negatively. Like, it just feels like a really exciting thing. I feel lucky, I feel incredibly lucky to be queer, and, like, at the moment I'm like, I feel like that's a part of my life even more than ever, and that feels like a blessing, rather, also because it means I don't have to primarily date cis men, which is great. but I'm lucky.
But you're lucky, but you're also, like, a product of your culture and time. And
exactly.
The fact that even that word queer, how that's been
changed,
reappropriated.
Yeah.
Oh my God, there are definitely times that I can think of where hiding my feelings for guys at school was like, oh, it just becomes all-consuming. It has to be this, like... And I think that was one of the reasons why I felt the need to come out, is just because it got rid of the distraction. I was just openly honest about it, it's like, yeah, and what?
Yeah.
Now
yeah,
I can go and do my GCSEs because I was a fucking nerd.
I really love you for it. That is why you've done the research on Tchaikovsky. We need you. Tell us more.
So in 1877, he had a bit of a beard moment. And
he bearded
and Tchaikovsky married a woman named Antonina Milyukova. I apologize in advance for my Russian pronunciation. And he told her pretty soon into the marriage that he would only ever be a faithful friend to her. And I'm always really conflicted when I hear stories like this, because I have such sympathy for the gay protagonist of the story, and Tchaikovsky must have been going through immensely troubling times for himself, but also I really feel for his wife. Like, that's really, really hard to go through, to marry a man, and he was probably quite a catch as well given his fame.
It's like it's the whole, like, concept of marriage and how we view that and how it was viewed, and the experience of women in marriage for so long, like that might have been a pretty good deal in some ways.
Yeah,
do you know
what
I mean? Like now we really expect like a fulfilling sexual relationship as part of our like primary lifelong partnerships.
Yeah.
To have a faithful friend actually who's not not obligated in that way, who knows? I mean, it's kind of fascinating again, isn't it? Just thinking about it with the lens of today's eyes.
This is slightly off track, but totally relates because I've been thinking about this so much recently. Like I've just fully like started to accept that I don't think I'll ever be in a long-term monogamous relationship because I don't think that exists. And then I read this article, my mum sent it to me, shout out to Sinead, queen, about why do we put all our focus on romantic relationships
when
like lifelong commitments are to your best friends. Those are the people that you keep in your life forever and ever.
Hell
and ever.
Yeah.
And there was this amazing story about these two women that met. They were like in the army together. And then while they were away, like one of them got divorced and then the other one got pregnant and then they moved home together, like separately, but to the same place. And then they both raised this kid together because they had different work schedules. So like one of them would pick the kid up from school and they'd like make dinner together. And then people at the school would be like, oh my God, they're gay. And they'd be like, no, we're just best mates and we raised this kid together.
For any of my friends that are listening, there's an opening. I'm just saying that is literally what I need. Yeah.
I'm right here. but yeah, I'm like, what is it? Faithful friends.
That's really interesting that there are these different, different ways you could think about that. For sure.
And I'm going to counter that and just say that the identity of the homosexual male in the 1800s was entirely different to the gay man now.
Yeah, of course.
And actually, Tchaikovsky probably wouldn't have aligned himself with the modern queer identity, and that probably would have been a step too far.
Yeah,
he would have absolutely been taking full advantage of being a white man in his life. And maybe his opinions on women's rights wouldn't have kind of aligned with how feminism and queer rights align in the modern day. Kind of worth bearing that in mind.
Yeah, really good point.
We kind of have to put this historical lens on his relationships.
Sure.
So he marries this woman, Antonina, and he writes to his brother whilst he's writing an opera, Eugene Onegin. That's the name of a very famous Russian book that he was turning into an opera. And he told his brother that he completely forgets about his wife in the time that it took him to write the opera. And moreover, from his letters at this time, it becomes apparent that he identifies as one of the female characters that he has written into the opera, further queering the history around Tchaikovsky and his music. As Richter Norton writes in his essay series Gay History and Literature, quote, his identification with a female paradoxically made him temporarily reject his desires for a male, or rather to be desired by a man like Onegin, end quote. And Onegin is one of the main male characters to this opera that he's writing. Just worth bearing in mind that, you know, like if this was something that was happening to him as he's writing an opera, then I think it's perfectly valid to kind of transfer that onto our viewing of the Nutcracker and to kind of look for the queer narratives in the storytelling there. And that he may well have been writing parts of himself as a man into some of the female characters. Obviously, he didn't choreograph the ballet, but he was thinking about the storytelling whilst he was writing the music and who would be on stage for which parts of the ballet.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point that you make there as well, is that it's almost like, I mean, for me, I feel like the thing of like changing the narrative or like this idea of queering it doesn't need any justification purely because it's been this historically so marginalised. And so that's kind of, it's our right to sort of do that in today's world. But it is true that, like you say, there's this like very specific historical context of what was going on and why it was produced in the way that it was, which we are completely like running off, running away from
and to be to be factual, artist subjective. So walking into the theatre, whatever you see on stage is what you see. And so our mere presence as queer audience members watching The Nutcracker, if we see a queer narrative, then that is as valid as the choreographer saying, but that wasn't my intention. If that's what we see, then that's the interpretation.
Man, that is a whole can of worms right there. If we start talking about interpretation, hermeneutics, I'm like, oh God.
What was that?
That's
word
a word.
You just said?
I know, we're going to have to Google it. Google it.
So, I've read it's been quite slated, this ballet, Luca, for this thing. So listen to this, right? First of all, Nutcracker can in no event be called a ballet. It does not comply with even one of the demands made of a ballet.
What?
Ballet, as a basic genre of art, is mimed drama and consequently must contain all the elements of normal drama. On the other hand, there must be a place in ballet for dances made up of the entire essence of classical choreography. There is nothing of this in Nutcracker. There is not even a subject.
What are they on about?
I know. This
wow.
This is a fuming critic after the opening night in like 1984.
Wow.
I know, right? In New York somewhere. I mean, there's this whole thing about Act One and Act Two, right? Like that they don't kind of work together or something, or that they're really disparate. And is that right?
Yeah. So Act One of the whole piece is really sort of story intense. It's the setting up for everything that happens in Act Two. And we see the family dynamics, we see the nutcracker given to Clara, Clara playing with a nutcracker, and then right at the end, the nutcracker comes to life and becomes a prince. And then the rest of Act Two is just them traveling through this magical Christmas landscape, but there is no storyline to it, really. They just kind of meet a load of people from different countries who all dance. But Act Two is the most exciting part of the play. There's a weird kind of subplot about the rats that come in, and they try and steal Christmas. They try and do something.
Oh my God, the rats trying to steal Christmas. Is that exactly for the Tories?
Rats are in 10 Downing Street having parties.
And I only say, yeah, exactly. I only say that in reference to the fact that the it's not necessarily that what might happen is necessary, but it's to do with the fact that, you know, if the NHS had been funded properly, maybe we wouldn't be where we are.
Amen.
The holiday.
Just a little note, little aside there that has nothing to do with any of the subjects. Rather like, although speaking of vaginas, who is Clara in this? Like, who is she?
How old is she? I swear she's like a teeny tiny baby. I swear.
But like, I guess like all like female protagonists in ballet, we're talking about like a real lack of agency generally, right? In terms of their narratives. And I'd imagine it's the same with Clara, is it, Luca? I don't know.
Yeah, so that is something that's quite interesting about Act Two, is that we have her set up as the protagonist of the story, and she's going to go on this amazing adventure with the Nutcracker. And then in Act Two, all she really does is watch the other people dance. And she doesn't really sort of interact with them on a sort of more dance heavy or narrative level than kind of just observing them and being entertained by these people dancing.
So we meant to be seeing it like through her eyes almost then, or
I think so. I mean, there's a pas de deux towards the end of Act Two with her prince, once the evil rat king has been defeated and they've watched all the lovely dances.
Sorry.
Never apologize.
What is with the rats though?
Yeah, sorry, but where did they come from? Why are they there? We were there for a second, they were gone. And I was like, okay, well, I guess that was a
thing. Do you think if you're cast as a rat, like, is that like...
Woo!
Well, so I've got two things to say on this. I think this is probably one where the critic that critic's opinion comes in, is because the rats are kind of there to try and be this level of threat and drama to the storyline, but they're so inconsequential to actually what happens, which is basically nothing. so they're a bit of a pointless sort of plot line. And secondly, my TikTok recently has just been awash of people in various ballet companies around the world obsessing over their rat costumes.
Oh really?
Like it's never the Nutcracker, it's never Clara who get like on my For You page. It's just the people that play the rats, and I'm here for it.
Ratty McRat face, we see you.
That's so funny.
Maybe if we're talking about queering though, you know, it's kind of that the I'm really like, don't, I'm not clutching at straws here. Yeah, okay. But this kind of notion of the abject, you know, the kind of other, the thing that is like the thing we'd rather not look at, or like rather not accept, or, you know, that maybe there's something around that, that feeling. It might, maybe it's a good moment for this Bell Hooks quote on that note.
Bell Hooks.
Who, rest in power, passed away on the 15th of December. And she wrote, queer is not about who you're having sex with. That can be a dimension of it, but queer as being about the self that is at odds with everything around it and has to invent and create and find a place to speak and to thrive and to live.
Like rats.
Like rats.
Wow.
Yes.
I mean,
rats are the original queer icons. Always 5 miles away or whatever that fact is. They're everywhere.
This is so not where I saw this going.
Sorry, Robin. Stand corrected. It is, if you're in London, you're never more than like 5 meters away from a rat.
Yeah, no, I
not
mean
rats
miles.
Are 5 miles away.
You're never 5 meters away from a queer. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, they're everywhere. Hello, we're lurking around every corner. Watch out.
Okay, so I didn't mean to draw that parallel with the rats, although I'm loving where you're going with it. But, you know, I'm just saying that, like, the rats have a bad reputation, right? And sometimes, but some people love them as pets.
Oh, this is true. Where are we going?
Okay, Ruth, I'll help you out. So, well, I think it's really, I think it's really important to kind of acknowledge that quite often the fight for queer rights isn't necessarily about living the same lifestyle that straight people have or heteronormative lifestyles are. It's about just being able to embrace the ways that we actually want to live.
Yes.
So there is something about the rat as like this kind of grubby little street creature that is thriving off of everything else, and it, you know, manages to survive and make it. They're actually really clean animals.
Yeah.
That's what I've heard, that rats are very clean.
Yeah.
So I think there is something about queer culture, you know, literature and art that really draws upon symbols of the underdog, or symbols of kind of like the shunned, the unwanted, the pest, because actually there's a lot of power to be found in that, and saying like, yeah, we're happy to be the rat, the empowered rat, not necessarily the, I don't know,
sugar plum fairy.
Yeah,
the sugar plum, exactly. Yeah.
No, a lot of queers out there would probably love to be the sugar plum fairy. No, that's a really significant and useful point, Luca, thank you. And I think that's why that Bell Hooks quote, I find it really, really powerful, because I think it's about, you know, and I think we spoke before about how, you know, it's important not to dilute queer to the point where it's meaningless, but also that there is something in what she says that really resonates for me when you're trying to kind of carve out a lifestyle that doesn't fit in to some of the heteronormative ways of being, that you feel at odds with like so much of culture and so much of what you're presented with, that it's very easy to start feeling like you're swimming against the tide, you're going the wrong way, you're in the wrong, you're wrong, you're different, you're you should be this, you should be that, you know. And I think it's, you know, it's really, really inspiring for me to hear you guys talking earlier about that in relation to Tchaikovsky. And I think, yeah, so that concept of taking power from that is beautiful. And I'm glad that the Rat King led us there.
Yeah.
what is happening in Act Two?
Act Two.
I feel like
in Act Two,
problematic themes potentially.
Yeah, definitely. So in Act Two, we have Clara and her prince, who was previously the Nutcracker, walking through the magical land, and they come to a palace where they are entertained by various different partner dancers from different nationalities around the world. Oh. And these dances are kind of supposed to represent the range of exotic cultures that at the time Russia would have been interacting with through political, economic, and kind of social exchanges in the late 1800s.
Okay, wow. So the nationalities are very specifically chosen then for that reason in the choreography?
Yeah, quite likely. And there's also, I think it's quite interesting that you've got sort of countries like, you know, the Nutcracker isn't the only ballet that uses this convention of having the national dances kind of making an appearance on stage. But I think it's quite interesting that you've got this real contrast between countries that are like Hungary and Poland, which are Eastern European and probably share quite a lot of things with Russia in terms of culture. And then, you know, further west, you've got Spain, who are going to be slightly, you know, more different. Also, it's worth noting as well that like in the 1800s, Spain, because of its trade links with North Africa and the Middle East, that you know, there is a large part of Spain of people with darker skin, and so they probably wouldn't have been treated with the same privileges as white people in that era, even though now Spanish people are deemed white by ethnic kind of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Sort of taxonomies or whatever classification,
right.
Perception. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, we haven't even gone there, have we, in terms of sort of how white ballet is. That's if we're talking about queering a ballet such as the Nutcracker.
And then sort of in Russia's eyes in this sort of era, on the far end of like the exotic other, we have the dances from Arabia and China.
Yeah, so but if we talk about like the choreography, what I find interesting is that it's gone from this like very classic kind of ballet, like as in that I would recognise as a ballet. You'd hope so, Ruth. Yeah, you'd hope. And that you made your whole career on dance. Yeah, thanks. But I just mean like some very classic corps de ballet scenes, etc. These kind of formations and structures that are very familiar and kind of part of the whole genre and style. But then in Act Two, it feels like it's almost quite kind of abstract in a way. It's just a series of duets, which feels like something I'd much more associate with a more kind of contemporary dance, or I don't know, like you say, there's no real story. We're just watching these kind of,
it's just like snippets. They don't roll into the next. Yeah. It's just like
one after the other.
Yeah, kind of.
Which is sort of in a choreographic way interesting, and like I say, got slated by the critics, and it's sort of been acknowledged as it's got this flawed version by Marius Petipa that's been reworked and tinkered with ever since it first kind of came out. But what, like looking through the eyes of now, as it were, like how do we feel about these kind of weirdly nationalistic dances that are probably not even real or representative? Yeah.
They feel very like, this is what I've heard, this is what I imagine this culture is like, but I'm not going to do my research, and I'm going to use dancers that don't know anything about that culture as well. I'm like being super like, I suppose quite vague, but obviously a lot of the time these dancers will all be white, and obviously in this case it was the Russian ballet. It just feels very, what's the word?
cultural appropriation?
I mean, yes.
Is that what we're looking at?
Yeah.
There was a really good quote from Lindsay Winship in a 2019 Guardian article, and she said, the European dances tend to be based on genuine folk steps, whereas the Arabian and Chinese variations were imaginative guesses, and the Middle Eastern dances were invariably slinky midriff exposed harem delights. So that's kind of really picking up on that. Like you said, Robin, there's not the sort of depth of research that's needed to correctly represent people from other countries or from other cultures on stage, other being like the non-Western white culture.
Exactly. And there's a strange tradition as well of like, if you people are familiar with dance, there's recent Dennis and Maud Allen who kind of did this thing of sort of, yeah, appropriating and taking on these kind of imagined styles of dance that they perceived to be kind of Eastern and therefore exotic, and therefore it gave them a kind of unique character. And they're sort of really interesting figures in history, but that it really, really tells a story of white privilege as well, of kind of how, because they were sort of representing this culture, they weren't therefore associated with the same stigma that an exposed midriff would be in any other context, or indeed by somebody who was actually from that culture. So really exercising white privilege in that context. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's interesting with the Nutcracker to think like how many times it's been reworked, and yet we're still here with these same dances, are we? I mean, is there a version, are there any versions that have kind of, I don't know, played with that a bit, or?
Yeah, I mean,
them up.
I mean, we can start talking about Matthew Bourne's reworking of the piece, which is really interesting in relation to these topics. So Matthew Bourne radically re-choreographed the Nutcracker for his version, and gone are these kind of sort of conventions of the rich white upper class hosting Christmas for the poor people, and it's actually set in an orphanage, and there's this really lovely scene at the beginning where we have the orphan children getting ready for Christmas, and they're super excited and really grateful for what is actually really quite sad, meager decorations. But there's this kind of that kind of whole
I said, I know the feeling. We've got like our eco Christmas tree inside them. It's fine.
Saving the Christmas tree at a time.
So it's completely reimagined and set in this Victorian orphanage. And then there is a kind of Nutcracker figure who then takes, I don't know if she's called Clara in Matthew Bourne's audition, but the Nutcracker takes the protagonist into this magical dream, Sweetie Land.
Ah, yes, Sweetie Land.
Sweetie Land, yeah.
Sweetie Land.
And all of the different dances, rather than representing different nationalities, they represent different sweets.
I like
rather than kind of
toffee fudge, humbugs. What's your favorite sweet, Robin?
Skittles.
Got that rainbow.
I love rainbow because queer. Very gay sweeties.
Oh my god, amazing.
Anyway, carry
sorry,
on.
Nika, sorry.
We like the naughty school children.
I love that though.
But I think one of the things about updating old choreography or, you know, dance traditions is that you kind of have to recognize that you will probably have to continue doing that forevermore, because the opinions that we have about race and culture or gender and sexuality or whatever the kind of social issues that we have around intersectionality our opinions of those things are going to change as we continue to exist on this planet. And so I think Bourne quite neatly sidesteps that whole can of worms and just goes, hey, it's not about nationality, it's about sweets.
Yeah.
And so actually we can have a version of the Nutcracker which completely sidesteps this and also allows us to blind cast the roles, because race is no longer
is it a
crucial
diverse
to the storytelling.
Is it a diverse cast of dancers?
Because, well, I'm glad you asked, Robin. Okay, because, the version that I watched on Vimeo was not.
Right. So this is my... If you're going to sidestep... Do you know what I mean? Very clever, but what are you actually doing? Like, you're not... There's not, like... If you're going to, like, create this radical version of the Nutcracker, like...
It's interesting, isn't it? Like hearing you say things like politically correct or can of worms, you know, it's really, and like you say, there is also this place for going, well, this is like become this iconic Christmas experience, is like people going to see the Nutcracker or watching it live stream or whatever new versions coming out. So it's not, and we don't want to go like, this cannot be ever, you know, we can't do this anymore. But at the same time, if you, it's interesting that thing of like, is it being, if we could make it right in inverted commas, should we not be doing that? Certainly in terms of casting, that is not about the representation, that is about the power structures within ballet as a sector, as a creative industry, as an art form being far less inclusive than it needs to be, and kind of passing that off as a sort of, you know, some kind of requirement, which it isn't, you know. So I think that that whole thing is like a separate issue, isn't it, to then actually how that, how it's worked in the choreography. And I kind of agree with you that the sweets is a really, it's a, I think it's quite a good,
it's a
solution in a way. Quite a good solution.
I think for me, I really hate this need for us to cling on to something traditional when it's come from a place of just outright misogyny, racism. You know, I'm like, why would we hold on to that? Why can't we keep it growing and keep it changing and keep it present? And maybe it isn't right and maybe it doesn't stay right, but maybe a reimagination that isn't a sidestep and is working towards representation. And it's also like, inevitably probably going to have criticism, but that's how we keep developing and that's how we get better.
Absolutely.
And that's how ballet hopefully can start to change and be more inclusive, because right now
And I think it's really important that dancers of color are given equal opportunities to, you know, progress up the ranks of the ballet company, you know, reach those soloist, those principal dancer roles. And they're also given the chance to audition for roles which have traditionally been always been danced by white people. But also, you know, there are, an argument could be made for ballets like the Nutcracker, which have these representations of other cultures in them. If they were to be updated in a sensitive way, then they could be a really good way to increase representation on stage if they were cast appropriately, and those roles were danced by people actually of those cultures.
Like rethink the whole national, the whole like duets from different cultures, and get choreographers in from those, you know, with that cultural background, and training in those, in those forms of dance. Like, why, like, what an amazing way to bring a genuine, authentic, diverse experience to the ballet and to each dancer and to the audience. Like,
and I guess then you also keep the, you know, there's the thing of popular culture, I know, which we touched on a bit last time with Matthew Bourne, where he sort of made this transition into this more like popular culture kind of world. And ballet also sort of treads that line, actually. And so sometimes it's kind of this thing of how to bring some of these issues out and get them, you know, being discussed or just being seen in contexts that aren't marginalized, that are more mainstream.
And So I can't claim that I have invented this term, but I'm going to say that Matthew Bourne's Nutcracker is the yassification of the Nutcracker.
Oh, slay! Slay.
And so for those of you who aren't... That's
true. I'm sorry, but we can't pass that
one. In the gaze of listening. Sorry, yassification.
Yeah, so those of you that aren't familiar with sort of drag queen vernacular and American, African-American vernacular English, yass is a term of like positive support for a performer and is often associated with queer culture. So yassification, therefore, is essentially the queering of something.
Oh, hey there.
Yeah, the yassification of the Nutcracker. And I think Matthew Bourne has done that in a number of ways, probably most obviously by taking ballet's camp tendencies to the absolute extreme. And everything, you know, camp as a vehicle of performance being extremely extreme art form. Everything is, as Susan Sontag says, you know, everything is in inverted commas. It's not a lamp, it's a lamp with bunny ears either side. It's a woman, bunny ears either side.
Yeah, it's like excess, yeah. Right? It's like all the muchness and the like extra, right? There's another way, like that's really extra.
Yeah,
it's
all the...
There's a double meaning to everything.
It's kind of commenting on itself, but in quite, I think, in quite a joyful way.
And subverting harmful stereotypes as well. That's traditionally what camp has been used for. And so where ballet can be problematic in its lack of agency for female characters, both narratively and physically, in Matthew Bourne's version of the Nutcracker, every dancer is being lifted and thrown about by dancers of the same sex or opposite sex.
Okay,
so there's
great.
Kind of this kind of equality to who's being objectified, who's being thrown, who's losing their agency in the choreography.
That's a great observation. I think that's super, super useful.
Yeah. And that's quite often done with this campy sexual lens where there are gags being made about how the dancers are touching one another, where they're holding each other as they're being thrown. Maybe they fall over and they land in awkward positions and everything is brought to the forefront of let's actually acknowledge how in classical ballet, like the overt sexuality of these relationships that are being played out on stage is really like purified and everything is quite naive in how they're dancing. And actually what we're representing is a sexual romantic relationship on stage, but it's all really clean and family appropriate.
Family appropriate.
Suitable for work.
What is going on with Clara? She's watching these dancers, but where's the sugar plum fairy? What's
Yeah, do you know, I don't have an answer for you, to be honest, because we have all of these amazing pas de deux from each of these different countries, and they're like the most exciting part of the ballet. They're the real highlights.
Music.
And then all of a sudden the sugar plum fairy comes out of nowhere. And I don't know what country she's from, but
Switzerland. That was like the only bit of music that made me go,
oh, it does.
Bruce was like, it's getting Robin, and I was like, oh my god.
It does does make you feel a bit Christmassy, that one. You can't help it. And apparently at the time it was the music, it was played, there's this new instrument called the celeste or something that was part of that piece of music that was very sort of
what, the plinky plonky,
the plinky plonky that hadn't been heard before. So I think it was like really, really please correct me, some music geek out there, if I've got that wrong, but I think that it was quite impactful, obviously, because it was a new instrument and it also made that sound. So that piece of music is iconic for various reasons.
Right.
It does make you feel a bit Christmassy, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it has really become like a symbol of Christmas now, that song. People hear it and instantly associate, you know, snowflakes and sweets and...
Can I just say that in the version we watched on YouTube, I really want to get hold of one of the snowflake crowns.
Yeah, oh my God. They were incredible.
Super yeah. queer.
So, big pom-poms on the end,
yeah.
like kind of these white crowns. I was like, you they can you stay need. In our queer version.
Sure.
They can stay.
The reimagination, we don't need any reimagination of those crowns.
We can keep those
honey.
Crowns, please, okay?
Yeah. Just saying. Let's hope they're not like rooted in some horrible.
Oh, God.
I mean, let's not start please. On the monarchy, darling.
Please, no, keep the there. Crowns. So the sugar pamphlet appears out of nowhere, does she? She's like a fairy. Oh,
she's there. She's there for a good time.
Not a long busy. Time.
She's covered in sugar. There's white powder of like, no. Yeah.
Okay. Sugar plum fairy, but she's a drag queen in our version of the Nutcracker.
Yes, that's an amazing idea. That's so
cool. Surely that does exist. If it doesn't.
I feel like that's out there. Also, the Nutcracker, very queer.
Very
I haven't even gone
we
into
even
that.
Gone there.
Christ.
Okay. I mean, if we're going to talk about sort of like the most, one of the, I wouldn't say most obvious, but maybe it isn't, one of the kind of things that I wish I saw more of in ballet was same-sex couplings. And like we've had all of these national dances, and we've had various pas de deux with other characters throughout the storyline, but because of the sort of heteronormative conventions of then and now, that still hasn't been challenged. And it would be lovely to have same-sex or just generally queer couplings.
I mean, it's 2021, mm-hmm. and this is the first series of Strictly, right, that's had a same-sex couple.
Yeah.
And again, that's like, again, that's partly associated with the conventions of ballroom dancing. Again, it's like, you know, each kind of sector, each sort of cultural sphere has its own codes and ways of being that are sort of behind even just general culture. Feels like we've kind of, you know, they do get sort of stuck in these conventions that are partly to do with trying to kind of evaluate or like mark or kind of, you know, judge, if you like, something on a standardized sort of score. So then that becomes like something new, is like, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in some ways, just in social life, obviously we're hopefully not spending the whole time judging people out of 10. We are in a fluid kind of way connecting with different people and in different social scenarios where those things are maybe less, in some ways, less rigid.
Yeah, don't you find it really strange now when these, you know, it's like on social media or whatever, it'd be like, oh yay, for the first time we've got a straight like a queer coupling, and you're like, what are you talking about? No, I'm not gonna say that. Like, it's too late.
Like, you're late,
do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't I'm not like woo, I'm like, okay,
well I'm
and it really I find it really irksome when that kind of celebration and
Can we just say that we both had a little moment there with the word irksome?
Me and Ruth are like, oh,
so good. I love that word. Sorry, Luca. Please carry on. It's so good. Anytime you can slip that into a sentence, guys, do it. Right.
I'm irked. Okay. I'm irked.
I'm irked.
Tell us what irks you.
What irks you, darling?
What irksome is just... What irksome is the... is the BBC or, you know, other broadcasters getting the accreditation, the like applause, the well done pats on the backs for being diverse. And actually who we should be celebrating are the dancers who are, you know, to some degree risking their careers still, risking social, you know, like you only have to go on the comments of some of these social media posts that are talking about same-sex couplings. You only have to hear about the television and marketing regulations complaints that have been sent in to know that there are still people out there who are like vitriolically violent and aggressive and abusive towards queer people. And so it's so important, I think, to make sure that the celebration is about the individuals dancing and not necessarily the big corporations at the top.
Absolutely.
And the executives at the top who are letting these decisions go through, like they are the last people that we need to be thanking for these changes.
That's a really important point, and I think it came up also in relation to dancers in general, didn't it, last time when we were talking about this, because we were like problematizing the ballet and some of the things about the Nutcracker, but that's also coming from a place of love, right? Certainly in respect for this form. And but there is also this thing that often happens with that where we forget about the dancers who've spent their lives training for this and kind of are the ones, you know, literally with the blood, sweat and tears making these productions happen. And so in our critiques, there is in no way a critique of that labor and that dancer's labor that so often gets erased in the face of the choreographer or the company. We never know the names of the dancers of the corps de ballet, for example. So I think
barely indistinguishable, like they all like blend. You know, after a few costume changes, like everyone just looks the same, and I mean, doesn't help they're all like white and hair stripped back, and you know,
there's so uniform, isn't there? So I think
beautiful.
Wasn't that nice? Wasn't that just nice? Finale of Act Two. How does this all end? This weird situation in which this Gunkel has given a wooden nutcracker to a pre-adolescent girl in the first act, and then proceeded to watch a bunch of culturally appropriated duets. What happens?
What the fuck is going on?
Via the Land of Sweets, which I have to say is my favourite thing, the sweets and the snowflakes.
It's the best bit.
Children, fairy, drag, loving all of that. How does it all end, Luca? Tell us.
So it all kind of segues into this kind of...
I wish the listeners could see your arm movements right now.
Is the dance...
I'm can't say it, did an interpretive dance.
It all just becomes this kind of haze, and it transpires that sort of maybe Clara dreamed everything that's just happened throughout Act Two.
Robin.
And she wakes up. She's probably been knocking back too many eggnogs in secret.
To be honest, I kind of wish that my dreams were a bit more like that, you know, like sugar plum fairies,
rat kings
hanging off trees. To be fair, the rat kings do make a regular appearance in my dreams. The queer rats are always in my dreams.
You love a bit of rat.
The whole like that thing of having like sweet dreams like that.
Sweet dreams.
Or maybe it's not sweet, actually, as we've been saying. Sorry, Luca.
Yeah, that's true. So she kind of wakes up and she's really disappointed that her Nutcracker Prince isn't real.
You would be, wouldn't you?
You would. I'm sure we can all attest to having dreams that we wish would never end.
So. Exactly, where you wake up and you're like,
you try to get back into them and you can't.
Yeah.
No.
But guess who's here to save the day? Only our favourite gay magic wizard Gunkel.
Gay wizard! Woo! Fuck Harry Potter.
And he sort of pops into the big hall at home with the Christmas tree in, and he says, there's someone at the door for you. And who walked through the door but a prince late to the Christmas party, the very same prince who she was dancing with in her dreams.
Oh. Right. Well, that doesn't make any sense.
Did you hear what happened to me then? I went all like, the prince has come.
Prince to me screams, run for your life.
Exactly.
I run, bitch. You are 13 years old, mama.
So the prince is the Nutcracker incarnate, is that right? Like it's the Nutcracker come to life.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm not sure how I feel about this.
I think no one knows, and I suppose that's the magic. But when you're...
I mean, it depends how much you want to read into it, because I think...
we're doing a whole podcast.
The whole point.
Reading into it. So let's go.
It really could be kind of seen as a narrative about, you know, the toys that we give to our children and how those toys are often a way of preparing children for adult life, and maybe the conventions of adult society that these kids are going to grow up into. And we see that in Act One anyway, with the presents that the kids are given. Like, you've got these swords for the boys, and the boys are all going to go off and train as soldiers and go and fight for king and country. The girls are given the dolls because they will be domesticated and have babies, many, many babies.
So many babies. yeah.
And they're kind of taught from a young age how to be good mothers, and that's sort through the vestige of giving young girls dolls and sort of.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I thought of it like that when we were talking about it earlier in relation to gendered norms, weren't we? But it's true that there's a sort of sense there also of sort of grooming them for those gender roles, those future gender roles.
Yeah.
So
I suppose the Nutcracker is kind of
play with.
He's like having the Ken for your Barbie, right?
I didn't even mean that. That was Robin's. Wooden man that you play with. We're just going to leave that one out there.
Do what you will with that information.
Do what you will. Yeah, absolutely unintentional, but brilliant. Thank you very much. My work here is done.
He's like a bar. What did you say, Luca? The wooden man. What did you say? The wooden man, you said like a Barbie or something.
Oh, he's like the Ken for your Barbie, right? Like you.
Okay.
You have all your Barbie girlfriends and you're playing with them, and you need the Ken. Right, you laugh, but I was the kid, if this doesn't tell you all that you need to know about me, I was playing with Barbies in preschool, driving around those motherfucking Barbies in their pink convertible car.
Yes! While
all the other boys were, I don't know what the other boys were doing. I didn't care because I was happy with my Barbies.
Yes, Luca.
I actually had Bratz dolls. They're much more inclusive.
Are they though? They're basically dead, which is another famous quote about ballerinas in female protagonists in ballets, is that they're only loved once they're dead.
Oh.
Just like Bratz dolls.
Wait, what? Bratz dolls are dead?
Aren't they zombies? Am I getting
confused? Oh, yeah, there's those, like, oh no, wasn't that Monster High?
Monster High. So
yeah, we're getting really sidetracked.
We're living.
We are getting very sidetracked. So are there any zombies in the Nutcracker? No, that's one later.
There aren't. There's rats though. But. Wait, okay, so no, just to kind of summarize that, maybe the Nutcracker could be seen as like the Ken for your Barbie, and that we're like, young girls are encouraged to play out romantic heteronormative scenarios between Ken and Barbie as a kind of way of conditioning them for finding a suitable husband later on in life.
Suitable husband, note to self, made of wood, doesn't answer back.
And can crack nuts with his teeth.
And can crack nuts with his teeth. Yeah, forever. I do love a good nut. Just the one. I said it singularly. There's no need for any smut in relation to that comment. Thank you. So in the choreography, what's the final thing that happens? Do they dance love and everyone's happily ever after? Or
yeah, they do. There is a sort of reunited pas de deux moment. Depending on the version that you go and see, sometimes there's like a little bit at the end where we have all of the different nationalities and the Sugar Plum Fairy, and they come back on and they're like, yay, and they celebrate. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes we're kind of, fade to black on our loving duo, Clara and the Nutcracker Prince.
Okay, what would our ideal queermas ending be?
She runs away with the Sugar Plum Fairy, obviously, and starts a whole new queer House of the Sugar Plum, mother. I am gay, very gay, very, very gay. Imagine.
I love that. I think that is the perfect.
That's a really good version.
Or. Yeah.
Nutcracker Prince arrives at the door at the end of the show, and Clara's like, oh my god, you're there. But then Nutcracker Prince, now alive, turns around and sees our Gunkle and is like, whoa. Actually, I want a bit of that.
But both endings can exist.
Yes.
Both endings can be the same. That can be the same.
Oh, they can. Yeah, they can. Because...
And that's perfect.
And we choose our families as queer people, guys.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're going to choose their queer family.
And so all the little kids and the swords and the dolls,
yeah.
That's all switching off in the background. We've got the big truck.
Yes.
We've got...
someone's got a big old truck.
They're playing with.
the Rat King is like, rather than being kind of like an allegory for the bad things in the eyes of like white Christianity, the Rat King is just Boris Johnson.
I thought you were going to say the Rat King is like got the snowflakes who are all like too self-preoccupied that they're all unique and special and is like taking their crowns and is like made some incredible like garland with them or something and is like just doing a bit of voguing in the- yeah.
Like, when are we rewriting this shit? Let's go.
If you have an
addition for our reimagination of the Nutcracker, please email us at dancefuturepodcast.queer.
Oh, I love it, guys. I love our version and I love these conversations and the fact that I'm never going to look at the Nutcracker in the same way ever again or hear that Sugar Plum Fairy music and it's still going to give me a festive twinkle, but now with an extra little va-va-voom every time.
Merry Queer.
Yeah.
Merry Queermas,
Merry
guys.
Queermas, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Woo!
Goodbye.